side of the house, sending their scent up to the windows above.
"If it makes you feel any better," said Mr. Burke, pausing by the garden wall. "He's not there now, at least not at Hudson House."
"That is not entirely reassuring, Mr. Burke."
"It wasn't meant to be."
Mr. Burke crossed the garden to her side in two brisk steps.
"I didn't think you'd thank me for false words of comfort."
Janey glanced away, up at the bare windows of the house. Imagination presented her with the image of someone standing there, at the nursery window, watching. Viola was playing a complicated game with Polly the Duck, skipping in circles around the garden, engrossed in her own imaginings.
"I think someone might have been staying in the house, in the nursemaid's room," Janey said at last.
Mr. Burke looked sharply at her.
"Here?"
"There were ashes in the grate, and the coverlet was rumpled. Of course," she added quickly, "there might well be a dozen other reasons."
"Mice?" suggested Mr. Burke. "Rodents of unusual habits?"
"I doubt a rodent, even an unusual one, could manage the coal scuttle."
Raising her eyes to his, Janey felt her shoulders relax a little.
"You don't think I'm imagining horrors out of shadows?"
"When you're living in a nightmare, even the shadows have claws."
The sun went behind a cloud, leaving the garden bleak and cold. More prosaically, Mr. Burke added,
"No, I don't. May I?"
He gestured towards the house. Janey tucked her cold hands beneath her arms.
"You were planning to anyway, weren't you?"
Mr. Burke's lips crooked up on one side.
"Perhaps. But," he added with mock solemnity, "I imagine it would soothe your harrowed spirits to have a bit of male company about the place. I could be persuaded to join you for lunch, purely for altruistic purposes."
Altruistic, her foot.
"There won't be anything elaborate. Mrs. Garrett wasn't expecting guests."
"And didn't I say my motives were selfless?"
Mr. Burke leaned back against the base of her grandmother's sundial, turning time to nothing.
"I'll settle for a loaf of bread, a jug of wine, and an apple beneath the bough."
"The boughs are bare."
Something about Mr. Burke's easy banter brought out the perverse in her.
"And it's a book of verses underneath the bough, a jug of wine, a loaf of bread, and thou."
"That too, then," said Mr. Burke, unperturbed.
Straightening, he added,
"We may want the jug of wine before the day is over."
"Are you planning to be particularly trying, Mr. Burke, or is it my company that cloys?"
She'd meant it as raillery, but it came out too close to home.
"Neither. Call it Dutch courage. Appropriate enough here, wouldn't you say?"
Mr. Burke gave his head a little shake, as though calling himself to order.
"If you knew something unpleasant was about to happen, but you couldn't do anything to stop it, would you want to know anyway?"
"No," Janey wanted to say. There'd been enough unpleasantness to last a lifetime already. But what poor sort of character would that make her? She didn't want to stick her fingers in her ears and let Troy burn around her. She would rather be out there with a bucket, flinging water at the flames.
"Yes, I would," Janey said at last. "And you don't know that you can't stop it. I don't believe anything's really inevitable until it happens. We just call it inevitable to make ourselves feel better about it, to excuse ourselves for not having done anything."
"Like her brother's death?"
Mr. Burke cast a wary eye on Viola, who was playing with Polly in and out of the legs of a stone bench. He moved to stand beside Janey, not touching her, but so close that she could feel the warmth of him through her coat.
"There's nothing you could have done."
"How do you know?"
The words wrenched out of her. Janey pressed the back of her hand to her mouth, wishing she could take the words back. She hadn't even known she was thinking them until she said them. But there it was. If she'd noticed Bay was missing, if she'd walked outside 5 minutes sooner, they would none of them be here. Tightly, Janey said,
"Tell me what you have to tell me, Mr. Burke. We've had enough theatrics."
Don't you think I wish it were?
Mr. Burke lowered his head towards her, his words for her alone.
There's another scandal about to break. Theodore Newland is citing your brother as a co-respondent in his divorce.
Newport, 1894. August.
I'm afraid there's no card with this one.
Janey handed Georgie a silver sugar shaker, elaborately chased with bulbous flowers that might have been roses, as imagined by someone who had never seen one.
Perhaps the sender was ashamed. I would be.
Janey swallowed a chuckle. At least, Georgie thought, it might have wanted to be a chuckle when it grew up.
I'll just put it on the list as unknown.
Balked of a proper wedding, society had deliberated and deemed it necessary to send wedding presents anyway. No one wanted to be accused of stinting Bayard Van Dyvel of his due, or being found wanting in the eyes of his English bride. Since gifts deserved a showing, Mrs. Van Dyvel the elder had sent out cards for a ball in celebration of her son's marriage. An entire room had been set aside for the display of society's munificence. Arranged for all to see were silver services crusted with the Van Dyvel acorns, gold-edged china from Limoges and whimsical figurines from Dresden, lace-trimmed tablecloths embroidered by nuns from Spain, and blown-glass ornaments from Italy. And then there were the jewels, more than Georgie could wear in a lifetime. Parures of garnets set in gold, aquamarines surrounded by seed pearls, combs and bracelets and pendants and rings. Mother Van Dyvel had gifted her with a tiara, and promptly taken it back again. It was to be hers on loan for the correct occasions.
"And when the time comes,"
her new mother-in-law had said with a tight little smile.
That time being, presumably, when the dowager Mrs. Van Dyvel shuffled off the mortal coil, leaving a daughter-in-law trained in her ways to bear the family tiara. The tiara was displayed in pride of place on a red velvet cushion, so that all might gasp at her mother-in-law's largesse and approval. It was a bit hard to remember that it was only 4 months ago that Georgie had been living in a garret room with peeling paper, with only the clothes on her back to call her own. And now, diamonds. On loan. That was nothing new, was it? Her life had always been on loan, a life lived on the fringes of Annabelle's. A Miss Smith wasn't on the same level as a Miss Lacey. Miss Smith took the chair farther from the fire, the smaller slice of cake, the plainer dress, and all because of an accident of birth that put her on one side of the bar sinister, and Annabelle on the other. How old was she when she had learned the truth? Georgie wasn't quite sure. Sometimes it felt like she had always known. Was it Annabelle who had taunted her with it? Perhaps. There had been times when they had been the best of friends, but Annabelle, charming when so inclined, loving when in the mood, had been ruthless in crushing what she saw as any display of rebellion with whatever weapon came into her arsenal. Annabelle. How odd that after all that had passed, Georgie missed her still. Missed her and loved her and hated her, all in one. What would Annabelle say to see her now, decked in silks and pearls, dining on gold plates?
So vulgar, but what would one expect of an American and an actress?
Bit by bit, Georgie found herself bringing Annabelle back, piecemeal, a gesture here, a turn of phrase there. She found herself adopting Annabelle's mannerisms, her inflection, that haughty tilt of the chin, that devil-may-care grin she flashed over her shoulder just before she did something that was bound to get Georgie into trouble later on. Some days she could almost imagine that she was Annabelle. She would look into the mirror and see Annabelle's face transposed onto her own. But it was only fair, wasn't it? A life for a life. A Lacey for a Lacey. She'd paid her dues. Wasn't it her turn to enjoy the benefits?
Annabelle?
It took Georgie a moment to realize that her sister-in-law was speaking to her, that the sugar shaker was leaving rose-shaped dents in her palms.
Are you all right?
Georgie gave her head a little shake.
Just away with the fairies. I stayed too late at that awful party at the Breakers last night. We ought to have left when you did. Did you know that...
That Mr. Newland put on an impromptu performance?
Janie's only sign of distress was the two circles of color high on her cheeks. With her fair hair dressed simply in smooth loops on either side, it made her look more than ever like a Dutch doll.
Yes, I heard.
Someone had slipped something into the punch, and Teddy Newland had serenaded his new fiancée with a lute purported to have belonged to Rizzio, the doomed lover of Mary, Queen of Scots.
It was dreadful, said Georgie bluntly. If Rizzio sounded like that, I don't wonder that Lord Darnley had him killed. He sounded like a stuck cat.
Janie ducked her head over the stack of gifts.
We're almost to the bottom. Would you like me to finish them for you so you can dress?
Many hands make light work, said Georgie in Mrs. Van Dyvel's most sententious tones,
and this time Janie did smile, just a little.
A servant in time saves nine?
If the servant is in time.
Georgie did her best imitation of Mrs. Van Dyvel, but if she'd hoped for confidences, the effort was wasted. Janie handed her the next package, wide and heavy.
This one is from the Rhinelanders.
Georgie hefted it.
What do you think's in it? Gold bars?
Oh, how lovely. A silver tray.
That made 18 of them. As casually as she could, she asked,
Did Bay ever pay court to carry Rhinelander?
Janie glanced swiftly up at her.
Carrie can be a bit temperamental, she said,
and Georgie was reminded that just because someone was quiet didn't mean she was unaware. She had begun to suspect that her sister-in-law was a great deal shrewder than anyone gave her credit for. She also wondered with just how many people Carrie had shared her belief that the new Mrs. Van Dyvel was a substitute for Anne. Not that Georgie believed a word of it. It was just mildly annoying, like a mosquito bite one couldn't quite reach. As she arranged the card in front of the tray, Janie said carefully,
We all played together as children. Bay was very close to Carrie's brother, Charlie Ogden.
Georgie racked her brains for a Mr. Ogden. She had met several, of various levels of paunch and floridity of face, but not a Charles that she could recall.
Have I met him?
No, but you will at the wedding.
There was no need to say which wedding. Anne's wedding was the wedding, the only wedding any of them spoke of, the wedding that had all of society gossiping, and Janie hiding like a turtle in a shell.
Charlie is Teddy's, Mr. Newland's, first cousin.
Everyone in New York appeared to be related to everyone else, with varying degrees of social distinction. In England, at least, these rules were laid out properly. One knew where one stood. Here, it was an unwritten code, but no less stringent for existing only in the minds of the cognoscenti. Georgie rose from her chair, rolling her stiff shoulders.
You need a Debrett's. It's impossible to remember who's who.
We have one, said Janie sheepishly. It's called the Social Register. Mother doesn't have a copy. She finds it vulgar. But I imagine you can find one at the Athenaeum.
So much for disappearing into the wilds of America. Georgie frowned at her sister-in-law over the shocking display of silver plate. From the ceiling, overripe nymphs simpered down at her.
Will I be in it now?
I imagine so.
Janie placed a stiff, cream-colored card against a Wedgwood vase.
They print a new edition every year.
It didn't matter, Georgie told herself roughly. Even if by chance Giles heard of an Annabel Lacey married to Bayard Van Dyvel, what could he do to her now? She looked out over the sea of silver and gold, the jewels glowing sullenly in the afternoon light, and breathed in deeply through her nose. Barbaric, she had thought it, when Mrs. Van Dyvel had told her of the custom of displaying the gifts. But now she found it comforting, like a warrior surveying the contents of an armory. What could Giles muster against this? Georgie Evans, actress, might be easy prey, but Mrs. Bayard Van Dyvel was another beast entirely. Mrs. Bayard Van Dyvel, nay, Annabel Lacey.
That's the last of them, I think.
Janie stepped back to survey her handiwork, the tables draped in damask, laden with a king's ransom in jewels and plate.
Thank you.
Georgie stood on tiptoes to press her cheek fleetingly against her sister-in-law's. I best find Bay and make sure he remembers where to meet for portraits before supper. Her mother-in-law had hired a photographer to record the occasion for posterity, a carefully orchestrated vision of the past, preserved for the future. Bay wasn't in their room or in his dressing room. His valet directed her to the library, where a maid, arranging flowers for the evening, bobbed a curtsy and said Mr. Van Dyvel might be in the gardens. Liveried footmen held the French doors for her as she exited through the garden front. Gardeners paused in their work to bow their heads. Pulling a veil down over her hat brim to shade her face, Georgie felt dazzled, and not just by the sun. It was mind-boggling to think that she was mistress of all this, or would be some day. Giles hadn't thought her good enough for Lacey Abbey, but she had fooled him. She had everything he had thought to deny her, and he, in an odd way, had been the very instrument of her triumph, driving her to London, to the Ali Baba, to Bay. She felt, as always, that surge of warmth at the thought of her husband, of Bay, humbled and half-frightened that he was hers, that after everything she had come to this fairy-tale place, with her handsome prince of a husband. And if she had to put up with a few Carrie Rhinelanders and a dragon of a mother-in-law, well, that seemed a just price to pay for the prince and the palace. Butterflies skimmed through the summer air, discomposed by the musicians already setting up their instruments, the servants carrying tables and lanterns. By the evening, the gardens rolling down towards the sea would be a fairyland. Now they were just busy. Light-footed, Georgie tripped along the lawn, past the formal parterres with their carefully shaped topiary, past the fountain, where tonight Poseidon would shoot water from his spear to the wilderness garden. She knew where Bay would be, away from the bustle, beneath the pergola that seemed to be peculiarly his own, screened with roses on three sides, with a view of the sea. Chapter 12. Newport, 1894. August. Georgie heard the voices before she saw them, first Bay's, low and urgent. You can still cry off. There was the sweep of a long skirt against the gravel as the wearer paced, turning with a flourish. Georgie drew closer, lifting her skirts so they wouldn't betray her.
The seamstresses are already embroidering the linens, Bay. Think what a waste it would be to have to unpick all of those monograms.
You don't marry for linens, Anne.
Not just for linens, no. There's also the silver and the china, and those amusing little ornaments that fit in the corner cupboard, and the yacht, and the house near Rhinebeck.
Through the gaps between the vines, Georgie could just make out Anne's face, her chin lifted to display all the fine lines of her face and neck, the pride of her carriage. She looked like a Burne-Jones princess, wrapped about with briars. They were beautiful, both of them, Anne and Bay, tall and golden. Anne's voice was husky and sweet as the scent of the flowers.
Is it so wrong to want something of my own, Bay?
But they're not yours, they're Teddy's.
And Teddy will be mine. I find him rather handsome, don't you? It won't be such a hardship.
Anne's voice softened, losing its arch edge.
Don't fuss, dearest. I know what I'm doing. I can manage Teddy.
And if you can't? The pain in Bay's voice woke an answering pain in Georgie. She bit her lip so hard she could taste the blood on her tongue. You don't have to do this. You don't have to marry for appearances.
No. Anne lifted a hand to Bay's cheek in a casual gesture of possession.
You did.
Georgie felt as though she were drowning, the water rising up around her mouth and nose. She couldn't seem to breathe. Her limbs felt heavy, too heavy to move. She blundered back a step, and then another, rose petals catching beneath her slippers, perfuming the air with their too heady scent.
But he married me, Georgie wanted to cry out. Why would he marry an actress but for love?
Her skirt must have given her away, the hem heavy against the ground, because Anne looked up. Coolly, without hurrying, she took her hand from Bay's cheek.
Oh, hello, Annabelle. Did you want us?
Bay turned, too quickly. If he had been a moment slower, Georgie would have been spared the expression on his face. Emotion. Raw emotion of a sort that Georgie didn't associate with her husband. Georgie wanted to shake him, to demand to know what had just happened. But what had she seen, really? Just two cousins talking. Talk. Only talk. She drew in a deep breath, grappling for composure.
Janie wanted me to remind you that we're to meet for portraits before supper.
Oh, yes, the ball, said Anne, and managed to make it sound like something impossibly gauche, a child's plaything. She placed a hand on Bay's arm, fleeting, caressing, a badge of ownership.
Proserpina, isn't it? And Hades. How fortunate we are to have you bring the spring to us, cousin dear.
Bay stepped too quickly forward, like a puppet handled by an inexpert master. Is it time to dress? I didn't hear the gong.
It hasn't gone yet. I was just...
Eager to see you? It made her feel childish to say it.
Indulging in an excess of caution?
Something about the way Anne said it, with a sideways smile at Bay, made Georgie want to take her corset tapes and pull them tighter and tighter until that satisfied smile faded from her face.
Very wise, cousin. Aunt Alva gets so cross when her plans are balked.
Bay crossed in front of Anne, blocking her from Georgie's view. Taking Georgie's arm, he said, Shall we go inside? You look rather flushed.
Have you had too much sun, Annabelle?
Anne's parasol mushroomed open, elaborately bedecked.
You must take care, my dear. Bay would hate for you to overexert yourself.
Anne managed to make everything she said sound like not a double but a triple entendre. It was just Anne's way, Georgie told herself. She couldn't help it. It didn't mean anything. But she couldn't help seeing Anne's pale hand on Bay's cheek. The intimacy of it. The familiarity.
I was born in India. This is nothing to summer in Madras.
Georgie looked across her husband at his cousin, tilting her chin in Annabelle's way, giving Anne the full effect of Annabelle's scorn.
The laces are hardy stock.
Anne twirled her parasol between her fingers, making the flounces bounce.
But you're a Van Dyvel now, cousin Annabelle.
To my infinite joy, said Bay, covering Georgie's fingers with his. But the words felt flat, joyless. They proceeded in silence up the steps. Anne furled her parasol and looked from one to the other with raised brows.
Until supper, then.
Georgie waited until she had gone into the house before turning to Bay and saying in a low voice,
A marriage of appearances?
Bay grimaced. You mustn't mind, Anne. A liveried footman was holding open the door, waiting, his face impassive beneath his white wig. It would be easier not to mind her if you minded her less, said Georgie in a low voice, before preceding Bay through the door. Bay caught up with her by a bust of one of Louis XIV's ministers that looked as though it had been looted from someone's chateau. It probably had. Anne was my childhood playmate and my closest friend. My mother, well, you've seen what she's like. We were left largely to our own devices. Georgie tilted her head back to look Bay full in the eye.
What sort of devices, exactly?
Bay blinked at her,
What do you mean? The mirrors lining the walls reflected them back 100 times over, distorted by palm fronds.
What do you think? You must have heard the whispers, Bay. You and Anne?
You can't think nothing like that.
He seemed genuinely shocked by the idea.
I love Anne like a sister.
Georgie started walking again, heels clicking against marble. She hated how small the house made her feel. She wasn't statuesque like her husband or her relations. A cuckoo in the nest, that was what Annabelle had called her. She was sick of being the one on the outside, always a step behind.
Do brothers try to break off their sisters' engagements?
Yes.
There was no mistaking the exasperation in Bay's voice. He moved to cut her off, grabbing her hands in his.
Yes, they do, if they think the man's a rotter.
Georgie's voice was low, scraped from the bottom of her throat.
But you would have let your own sister marry him?
With reservations. You know I've never liked Teddy.
Bay squeezed her hands, leaning down to try to see her face under the brim of her hat.
And Anne's not Janie. Anne feels everything so deeply.
Georgie twitched her hands away.
What makes you think Janie doesn't?
Bay held up his hands in surrender.
Perhaps she does. I don't know. Janie's the Rosetta Stone to me. She's written in a language I can't make out. But Anne...
The way his voice softened when he said Anne's name made Georgie want to spit.
What makes you think you know Anne so well, or that you know what would suit her best? Have you ever stopped to think how it must be for her, living in your mother's house, dependent on your mother's largesse for every cent she spends? It's horrid living on someone else's charity.
So kind of them to take her in. That was what everyone always said. How fortunate Miss Georgiana was, how grateful she should be. Grateful that she had to exist on crumbs while her half-sister had the cake?
It's not charity.
Bay caught himself.
Not really. We're family.
There's family and there's family. Didn't you tell me this was once Anne's father's house? Can you imagine what it must be to be a pensioner in your own home? No, of course you haven't. You're Bayard Van Dyvel, and nothing you've wanted has failed to be yours.
Bay's face was very still. Only his throat worked, the Adam's apple moving up and down.
That's not true.
Georgie looked defiantly at him.
All right, then. Name one thing you've wanted and couldn't have.
Bay's mouth opened, but no sound came out.
A simpler life, he said at last.
That's rubbish.
Georgie turned on her heel, feeling her shoulder blades tight beneath her dress.
This is a brilliant match for Anne. If you care for her at all, you'll leave her be.
Georgie?
Bay's hands were on her shoulders. Usually he called her that only in private, in their own bedchamber.
Georgie, let's not fight.
Georgie only shook her head without looking at him. In one breath, she said,
Carrie Rhinelander thinks that you only married me to get your own back over Anne's engagement.
Georgie could feel Bay's breath against her hair.
Carrie Rhinelander is a nasty busybody who wouldn't know an honest emotion if it bit her.
Georgie turned in his arms, looking up at him.
Then what did Anne mean about your marrying for appearances?
Bay's eyes shifted away from hers.
When Anne's unhappy, she lashes out, however she can. She doesn't bother with Queensbury rules.
A hit is only a hit if there's something to hit.
Bay's hands tightened on her shoulders.
If I had wanted to marry someone for appearances, don't you think I would have chosen from my own set?
His voice softened.
You know why I married you, Georgie. I married you because I couldn't bear to let you go.
It usually made her feel warm through and through when he said that, but today it left her cold.
And to save me from Giles,
she reminded him. Her hands flattened against the lapels of his coat. I feel I know you less here than I did in London.
I hate Newport.
Bay ducked his head, abashed at his own vehemence.
There's no space between spectacle and reality. I always feel not myself in Newport.
London, then, said Georgie softly. What were you in London?
More myself for being with you.
Bay's blue eyes met hers, rueful, genuine. The man she had met in London, the man who had sat across from her at the Feathers night after night, who had endured a dozen performances of 11 and 1 nights. This was the man she had married, the man she loved.
Was it selfishness to bring you back with me?
No, unless it was my selfishness as well, to want to come with you. Georgie ought to have felt reassured, she supposed, but instead she felt obscurely troubled by worries she couldn't quite name.
Maybe Bay was right. Maybe it was Newport, that hothouse environment of spectacle and show where everyone whispered about everyone else. Maybe it was feeling herself under public scrutiny, knowing her very name to be a lie. Easier, perhaps, to look for weaknesses in others than to admit them in herself.
Bay touched her cheek with one finger.
"Shall we dress? If you can bear the costume my mother chose for you."
"I've worn worse." It was the first time either of them had touched on her past, and it felt strangely intimate, something that was theirs and theirs alone.
"At least this is a skirt, not trousers."
The corners of Bay's eyes crinkled.
"I rather miss those trousers."
Georgie twined her arms around his neck, heedless of servants, of potential watchers. Let Newport gossip about how shamefully in love the Vandivals were.
"I might be persuaded to put on a private performance."
Gently, Bay unwrapped her arms, lifting first one hand, then the other, to his lips.
"Tonight's performance first."
He cocked a brow.
"Should I be alarmed that my mother has cast me as Hades?"
"Why should you be alarmed?" said Georgie, trying not to mind. He was right, of course. The gong would go at any moment, and Mrs. Vandivel didn't brook lateness.
"I'm the one who's about to be dragged down to the underworld."
"For love," Bay reminded her. "For love." Cold Spring, 1899. January.
"How did you come to write for the papers?"
With Mrs. Garrett serving, lunch was a necessarily stilted affair. One couldn't discuss delicate matters with Mrs. Garrett slapping dishes on the sideboard with a brisk efficiency that intimated that her time would be better spent elsewhere. She had already demonstrated her displeasure by showing Janie and her guest into the breakfast room rather than the dining room, as no company had been expected. Janie and Mr. Burke had already discussed the unusually cold winter, whether the winter was really that unusually cold or it only seemed that way, and supplemented it with a précis of winters that had been either unusually cold or unusually mild. Having exhausted the weather as a topic, Janie cast about for something else suitably anodyne.
"You make journalism sound like a social disease," said Mr. Burke,
leaning back in his chair with exaggerated ease. Janie had noticed the way his eyes took in the richly paneled room, the stained glass, the Italian marbles and Flemish tapestries. In response, he had adopted a smilingly pugilistic manner that made conversation almost as difficult as Mrs. Garrett's silent disapproval.
"Do I? I didn't mean to. I have a cousin who writes for the papers," said Janie by way of apology. "Or thinks he does. It's mostly doggerel verse, all in rhymed couplets. When he gets away from his nurse, he sends large parcels to the papers."
She decided not to add that said cousin claimed to be the reincarnated soul of Lord Byron, John Donne, and on alternate Tuesdays, Shakespeare. The Byron days were particularly trying for his poor nurse, who had to suffer being pinched on top of being recited at.
"There are no rhymes in mine," said Mr. Burke.
Reluctantly, he said,
I came to the paper by way of the theater. I got my start performing in Mr. Hearn's plays.
You were an actor?
Perhaps that explained the odd sense of familiarity, the sensation that she had seen Mr. Burke's face, or at least his name, somewhere before.
Not a very good one.
Janie remembered that first meeting in the kitchen, in his imposture as Katie's cousin. She looked skeptically at him over the remains of her apple tart.
Or so you claim. It might take a good actor to play a bad one.
You have a devious mind, Miss Van Dyvel.
It did not sound like a compliment. Janie gave her napkin a twitch.
Call it, rather, common sense.
Another gift from your Dutch ancestors?
Mr. Burke raised a brow, deliberately provoking.
Along with the Delftware, of course.
Was he trying to change the subject?
His theatrical career appeared to be something Mr. Burke had no desire to discuss,
which, of course, made Janie all the more curious.
How did you go from theater to your current profession?
Sure, and it's all a form of the human comedy, isn't it?
Janie frowned at him, refusing to be deterred.
Did you always want to be on the stage?
I wanted to eat, said Mr. Burke bluntly. I drove a milk wagon for a time, but given that I didn't like the dawn and the horse didn't like me, it seemed better to look for other employment.
So you exchanged milk bottles for an inkwell?
Said Janie, for lack of anything better to say. It seemed very hard to imagine the urbane Mr. Burke on the seat of a milk wagon.
You don't seem...
common,
Mr. Burke offered, and Janie felt her cheeks redden. He pushed his plate firmly back.
Let me dispel any illusions you might have about me, Miss Van Dyvel. I'm as common as they come. I was a foundling, left on the steps for the nuns.
That's very romantic, Janie ventured.
No, said Mr. Burke, it's not. There were dozens of us left every week, the unwanted ones. There were so many of us that they had a cradle put outside the church, for deliveries, you might say.
The bitterness in his voice made Janie flinch.
You don't know that nobody wanted you. Your mother might have been ill. She might have had no other recourse.
She'd seen it often enough at the girls' club, women who had taken one misstep, forced to hide their conditions, give up their babies. She'd seen them crying in secret, only in secret, because to admit the truth would mean ruin.
This might have been her way of giving you a better start in life.
Or of getting rid of an impediment.
Mr. Burke smiled crookedly.
You're determined to make a heartwarming story out of this, aren't you, Miss Van Dyvel?
Janie wasn't willing to let it go that easily.
But just think, you might be anyone.
Mr. Burke choked on a laugh.
A lost prince? You've been reading too much Little Lord Fauntleroy. More likely I'm the illegitimate child of some poor soul just off the boat.
That's not what I meant.
Even if it had been. Janie rested her palms on the table, in heady defiance of her mother's strictures.
Just think. You can be anyone you want to be. You have no family telling you how you're meant to behave, or what you're meant to do or meant not to do. There's the whole world in front of you for the taking.
For a moment, he almost seemed to be listening. But then he gave his head a quick shake.
Or for the stealing. I've lived in ways you can't imagine.
Janie didn't have to ask what he meant. Even she had seen it through the windows of the carriage, the young children huddled together in alleys for warmth, scavenging for food.
You're right. I can't imagine it.
Janie stared down at her own hands, so smooth and unscarred, the nails carefully shaped.
There are times when I look at the women at the girls' club and wonder if I could have lived as they have lived. I wish I could be that strong. I don't think I would do as well if I tried.
Wouldn't you?
Burke leaned back in his chair, his eyes on her face.
You're not at all what I expected.
My mother feels the same way.
She'd meant it lightly, but it didn't come out that way. Abruptly, Janie said,
"Would you like a cup of tea before you leave for your train? We can take it in the library."
"A foundling taking tea at Elyria. Your ancestors must be rattling in their graves."
Mr. Burke rose and circled to the back of her chair to draw it out for her.
"Do you have anything stronger than tea?"
Janie slipped out of her seat, very aware of Mr. Burke behind her.
"Sherry, I think."
He gestured her to precede him, a strangely courtly gesture for a former milkman.
"I'd say the day calls for it, wouldn't you?"
"Mrs. Garrett,"
said Janie, feeling defiant and bold,
"would you bring the tea things to the library?"
"For propriety's sake, I take it," murmured Mr. Burke, as they walked together from the breakfast room to the library, down a corridor paneled in dark wood and hung with the murky portraits of someone's ancestors.
"Do you mean to drink your sherry from a teacup?"
Janie's flush gave her away. Mr. Burke gave a bark of laughter.
"How can you be bold enough to seek me out, but not bold enough to take a tipple in your own house?"
"It's not my house," Janie pointed out. "It's Bay's." "Was Bay's."
The reminder sobered them both. Janie felt the full oddity of it, entertaining a stranger in Bay's house while Bay's body lay cold and still in the frost-blasted ground of Greenwood Cemetery. For Bay, she reminded herself. Her association with Mr. Burke was for Bay, to discover the truth of his death. The library felt surprisingly cozy for such an imposing room. A hastily lit fire smoldered in the grate beneath a vast stone mantel looted from a French chateau, casting a warm light over shelves made of oak inlaid with maple. The walls between the shelves and the ceiling had been hung with red silk chased with gold, a pattern echoed in the long drapes that were elegantly looped back from the long arched windows on the western wall, providing a view of the grounds and a tantalizing glimpse of the river below. Paintings hung pendant in gilded oval frames, portraits, all of them, a parade of Vandyvals, copied, she imagined, from the portraits in the old house. Ancestors in periwigs and mob caps, ruffled fichus and brown snuff coats, coquettish ringlets and bristling whiskers. Janie recognized her mother, resplendent in jewels in the costume of the early 1880s, sometime before her father's death. And there was her father, quietly pleased, she imagined, to be back among books. The watch pinned to Janie's bodice said it was just past 3, but the early winter dusk was already beginning to fall, painting the landscape in shades of pewter and gray, making the red opulence of the library seem even warmer in contrast. Mrs. Garrett set the tea tray between the windows, and, leaving the door pointedly ajar, left them to their tea. Or something stronger. There was a decanter on a silver tray, surrounded by glasses of Austrian crystal. It was filled with an amber liquid. Defiantly, Janie bypassed the tea tray and took up the decanter, finding it rather more difficult to grasp than she had expected. It had been made for larger hands than hers. Trying to look as though she imbibed spirits every day, she said,
"Would you rather tea or sherry?"
"I rather doubt that's sherry," said Mr. Burke. "But I'll risk it if you will."
Clumsily, Janie poured one glass, then another, grateful in an odd way that Mr. Burke didn't offer to help. Whatever it was, it certainly didn't smell like sherry. It had a peaty smell that made her think a bit of her father's library, although whether it was because her father liked old books or had enjoyed a drink or two in the evenings, she couldn't say. Mr. Burke accepted his glass from her and raised it in a toast.
"To your very good health, Miss Vandyvel."
"And yours."
Janie screwed up her courage and tilted the glass back as he did, only to find her throat on fire. It burned all the way up her nose and along her ears. Her eyes watered with it.
"That," she said hoarsely when she could speak again, "is not sherry."
"Best Lafroig, I should think," said Mr. Burke appreciatively. "Sip, don't gulp."
Janie coughed again and held the glass up to squint at the liquid. It looked deceptively innocent in the firelight, like weak tea with honey.
Is this what men slink off to drink?
Among other things.
Mr. Burke held up his glass to her in salute.
But seldom sherry.
So you say,
said Janie, and took another experimental sip. It made her feel quite dissipated and worldly.
And why not?
She thought defiantly. The world had turned upside down. It was foolish to apply the old rules, the old standards. And she was so very sick of being proper.
Do you know, said Mr. Burke meditatively, that while the whiskey is aging, a fair bit disappears into the air, as it were? They call that portion the angel's share.
The words made the hairs on the back of Janie's neck rise. She took another sip of her drink, holding the taste on her tongue.
It's a bit eerie to think of unseen beings drinking from the cask.
Lifting his glass up to the firelight, Mr. Burke recited,
"Yesterday upon the stair, I met a man who wasn't there. He wasn't there again today. I wish he'd go away."
Janie caught herself looking over her shoulder, squinting at the shadows.
Did you just make that up?
I write in prose, not verse. It's a bit of doggerel a friend sent me. Hughes Mearns. It's a song for a play he's writing. But it does rather hit it, doesn't it?
Yes, said Janie soberly. It does. Rather too well.
An unseen head on a bed. An unseen hand stoking the grate. Mr. Burke set his glass down on the table beside him, resting his hands on his knees.
"Would you like me to take a look at the room in the other house before I leave?"
"Will it appear in an illustrated supplement in the World?"
"Not unless there's a body hidden there."
Mr. Burke grimaced.
"Sorry. In the newsroom we—well, the worse it is, the more of a joke we make it. It's a way to get through the day without being sick."
Janie gave a slight nod to show him she understood. The room nodded a bit with her.
"I almost wish there were a body on the bed."
That hadn't come out quite right somehow. She wrinkled her nose.
"It seems rather horrible to hope for a corpse, doesn't it? It's not that I want Annabelle to be dead, but it seems so cruel to let Viola and Sebastian hold out the hope that she might return to them. If her body were found, if we could bury her and let them mourn her..."
"Then they wouldn't have to some day face the fact that their mother might be a murderer."
Mr. Burke looked at her steadily, looked at her until she was forced to meet his gaze.
"You've considered it too, haven't you? That Annabelle might still be alive?"
Chapter 13. New York, 1899. January. There it was, the crack in the vase, the stain on the tablecloth, the topic that had been hanging over them both.
"And hiding in her own house?"
"A murderess," said Mr. Burke, "returned to the scene of the crime to burn the evidence. She knows the house, she has a motive. It makes a compelling story. Wronged wife stabs husband and flees, the classic crime of passion."
"Wronged wife?"
It took Janie a moment to realize what Mr. Burke was talking about.
"You don't really think—"
"Mr. Newland cites your brother in his divorce petition. Alienation of affection."
Mr. Burke tipped back in his chair.
"Amazing, isn't it, the way a lawyer can manage to make even a love affair sound stale?"
"Bay and Anne? No."
Never mind that she had once wondered the same thing herself. It was one thing to harbor suspicions, another thing to trumpet them abroad in legal proceedings. Janie shook her glass, watching the bit of liquid at the bottom redistribute itself.
"There must be some misunderstanding. I can't imagine why Teddy would—"
"Teddy, is it?"
Mr. Burke rose from his chair, crossing to the decanter. He paused next to her chair, looking at her assessingly.
"I'd forgotten. You were engaged to him once."
Janey made a quick gesture of negation. Never engaged. Just an understanding. Not even an understanding, more of a misunderstanding.
She would have lifted her hand to tuck a strand of hair away, but her glass appeared, oddly, to still be in it. She drained it and set it down, her voice rusty from the spirits.
Our mothers wanted the match. And Teddy... Well, it's very hard to say no to my mother.
He seems to have managed it.
Mr. Burke yanked the crystal stopper out of the decanter.
Otherwise you would be Mrs. Newland now.
Not by choice. But it seemed foolish to say that. The lady protests too much, that was how the saying went.
No one would believe it. No one would believe that plain Janey Van Dyvel might balk at handsome Teddy Newland, toast of the Union Club.
Mr. Burke splashed whiskey into a glass.
You could probably get him back if you liked, slightly the worse for wear. Never mind that he'll never appreciate you as he should. I'm sure you'll have lovely blue-blooded children.
Janey flung her hands in the air in frustration.
My blood isn't any bluer than yours is. Probably less, for all I know. My ancestors were merchants, that was all. We sold silks and tea. Our blood isn't blue. It isn't even purple. And Teddy's great-grandfather was a fur trader, she added for good measure.
Old Mr. Newland might have skinned his own otters with his bare hands, but his daughters wore silks, and his grandson sat on committees.
Mr. Burke set the decanter down gently on the rosewood table.
If you really think that doesn't count for anything, you're fooling yourself.
It didn't protect my brother, did it?
The words choked in Janie's throat.
Never mind. I didn't mean to say that.
Mr. Burke's voice softened.
I am sorry, you know, about your brother.
He reached for the decanter.
Have another glass of whiskey.
Why not, after all? Janey held out her glass to be filled.
I just can't believe Teddy would imply that Anne and Bay... It's monstrous!
Mr. Burke returned the decanter to its tray, leaning back against the table.
Is it? There's no law prohibiting cousins marrying. It's been done before, quite frequently.
Janey gulped down a substantial portion of the contents of her glass.
My mother would never have allowed it. Bay was... He was meant to make a far better match.
And instead, he married an unknown Englishwoman, said Mr. Burke softly.
Yes.
Janey had never thought before that Annabel might be a substitute for Anne. Annabel, Anne, even the names sounded the same. They looked nothing alike. Annabel had been small, slight even, with dark hair and eyes and a narrow pointed chin, while Anne's was a golden beauty, all classical features and bright colors like a portrait newly painted. Like Mary, Queen of Scots, aware of her own charms, lips primmed in a self-satisfied smile that lasted through centuries in cracked paint. But there was something similar about Anne and Annabel all the same, a way of taking on the world, a sense of secrets unspoken. Mr. Burke set his glass down, holding out a hand to her.
"Shall we examine the room in the other house, while you're still capable of locomotion?"
The world quivered disconcertingly when Janey looked up at him. She felt as though she were on the deck of a ship, everything swaying slightly.
"I'm not the least impaired!"
It might have sounded more convincing if the words hadn't been slightly slurred.
"As you will,"
said Mr. Burke, offering her his arm. It was a stronger arm than Janey had realized. Not the showy strength of Teddy, who bragged of his prowess on the tennis court, but a lean strength. Fencing? Janey wondered vaguely. Actors tended to do that sort of thing. Or perhaps hauling milk bottles. Either way, she was grateful for his aid. Her skirts were much heavier than usual, and seemed inclined to tangle about her ankles. Full dark had fallen, turning the gardens into something dark and sinister. Behind them, the lights of the library glowed dimly through the French doors. but the light only served to emphasize the darkness beyond. Down, 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 to the folly and the river. Janie swayed slightly, Mr. Burke catching her around the waist.
All right?
All right. Just, everything looks different at night, doesn't it? I'd forgotten how dark it gets here.
There was a moon, silvering the frost on the blasted grass, creating shadows in strange places.
It makes you miss the street lamps, doesn't it? Said Mr. Burke.
And the noises, said Janie.
It was painfully quiet, their footsteps crackling on the hard ground, their breath misting in front of them. She could hear every rustle of her skirt, every brush of Mr. Burke's sleeve against hers.
Isn't it odd? I don't hear the noises when I'm in town, but I miss them when I'm here.
She had grown up with the rattle of carriages, the shouts of vendors, the prattle of people in the street below.
"We're odd creatures, aren't we?" said Mr. Burke. "We city dwellers."
Janie nodded. He might have grown up in Hell's Kitchen while she was in the rarefied air of East 36th Street, but they both had the city in their bones.
"Not Bay, though," she said. "He wanted nothing but to stay here."
Or maybe it was Annabelle. Annabelle, who had grown up in a great house in the middle of the country, who had hated the noise and bustle of the city. They had abandoned their plans for a home of their own in the city, declined all invitations, devoted all their energies to recreating Annabelle's home on the Hudson. Wasn't that a sign of love? The old house was in front of them. Mr. Burke stepped back to allow Janie to precede him up the stairs. She paused on the top step, looking back, frowning at him through the gloom.
"Bay wouldn't break his vows to Annabelle, whatever his feelings for Anne."
Mr. Burke looked up at her, one brow raised.
"Love makes men do strange things."
"But does it make them someone other than themselves?"
Janie yanked open the door, felt herself stagger as it gave more quickly than she had expected. She grabbed at the wall to steady herself.
"Love is supposed to ennoble the soul, not degrade it."
Mr. Burke followed her into the house, shutting the door behind them. Without the moon, it felt very dark in the hall, very dark and close. He leaned a hand on the wall beside her head.
"You've been reading too much poetry, Miss Van Dyvel. An honorable man might steal to feed his starving child. That's love, too. Is that out of character?"
Janie squinted at him, trying to make out his features.
"But it's not the same. That's a question of survival."
"And love, romantic love, isn't?"
Mr. Burke's voice was very soft. Janie could smell the whiskey on his breath, feel his arm flex as he leaned against the wall.
"If you can say that, Miss Van Dyvel, you've never been in love."
Janie wasn't sure why, but she found that particularly infuriating. Perhaps because it was true. She shifted, bringing their bodies closer, chest to chest.
"Just because I don't believe love needs to destroy everything it touches?"
"Let Rome in Tiber melt, and the wide arch of the ranged empire fall. Here is my space."
Mr. Burke's voice was beautiful in the darkness. Janie could feel the words like a caress.
But not for her. They were someone else's words. Antony's to Cleopatra. Mr. Burke had been an actor once.
Janie lifted her chin.
"Kingdoms are but clay? That's not love. That's selfishness."
Mr. Burke laughed softly.
"Mark Antony wasn't exactly known for his public-spiritedness. But then it was his enemies who wrote the histories, so what do we know?"
Here in this dark and empty house, what did she know indeed? Janie felt strangely deflated. Janie ducked her head.
"Nothing."
What did she know of love or hate or deep emotion?
"Nothing at all."
Mr. Burke put a finger under her chin, tilting her face up.
You're shivering.
Janie met his eyes.
It's cold.